Good evening, everyone. My name is Mark Torgerson. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Oh, you guys nervous? I am. It's been a while. 2 months ago, Brownie came and chatted with me about coming to do this talk, so I've had 2 months to think about this. It would have been a lot nicer if someone would ask me at 9 o'clock this morning. I think that would have gone a lot better for me. I have a mind of an alcoholic, and I like to think. So, but before I get into anything, I'm going to start with a prayer here. It's called the set-aside prayer. Dear God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, the big book, the 12 steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship in all spiritual terms, and especially about you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me see the truth. Amen.
Amen.
That's called the set-aside prayer. I do that before I do any work with any sponsees. I do it before I do any kind of big book study. What it does, I think one of the biggest nooses around any of our necks is to think we already know everything. Whether it's, for me, it's because I work with a lot of people, and sometimes I think I know more than I do, right? And sometimes it may be someone that has a lot of time in the program, might be some ideas you might have from a sponsor, might be some ideas from things you might hear in the government, who knows, right? So anyways, this invites us to have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. First and foremost, I would like to thank the committee again. Please, everyone. I'm going to pre-apologize. I may offend a few people tonight. It's not going to be my intent. The odd swear word might come out of my mouth. Not sure. Here's where my alcoholic mind took me last night. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I've been taking notes here for weeks on this talk, right? I'd take a few more notes. And last night I was trying to put this all together. I was trying to tie it all together. And I had about 30 pages of notes. So watch for the upcoming novel, Memoirs by Mark. And what I realized is, about midnight last night, I had a little meltdown. I'm looking at these notes, and I'm looking at these notes, and I'm not liking what I'm seeing, not at all, right? And I had this little meltdown about midnight last night, and I threw them all in the garbage, and I kicked the garbage can, and I'm like, cursing Brandon, cursing AA. And I didn't like any of it, right? I'm going to take a bit of a different approach with everything here tonight. The reason why I didn't like my notes is I was looking at them all, and it was just another drunkalogue, right? And I don't like drunkalogues. I'm going to share a few things tonight that have to do with my story, but it's not my war stories that make me an alcoholic. And that was a really confusing thing for me when I first came into these rooms. I'd hear one person say, well, I'm an alcoholic because I got 4 DUIs. I'm like, well, I don't have 4 DUIs. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Then I hear someone else say, well, I'm an alcoholic because I spent 15 years in prison. I'm like, well, I didn't spend 15 years in prison. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Right? And I hear the next person say, well, I'm an alcoholic because I live under a bridge. Well, I'm not living under a bridge. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic, right? And what I realize is these war stories that don't actually bring us together, I think they separate us, right? What I wanted to talk about tonight, and here's me at midnight last night after having my little meltdown and kicking my garbage can and being all angry, throwing my notes in the garbage. And then about 12:15, I realized, like, what the hell am I going to say, right? I got nothing. So I got driven back into what I was taught, which was prayer and meditation. And I thought about what the topic was tonight, which is unity and recovery. And it's like, okay, well, what brings us all together? You know, like sometimes we don't even like each other, right? But what actually brings us all together? And it brought me to page 17 of our big book. And I am going to read from the big book tonight. So for you, those that don't believe the message comes from the book, this is going to be a long talk for you. And this has to do with unity and recovery. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in our powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Right? Not my solution, a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree. Precisely how we have recovered, right? We have a way, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. So just bear with me, guys. I am nervous, so it's going to take a while to kind of shake off some of these jitters. I have a real special bond with this particular group. As Dan said, I was here when it was a God-directed intuitive thought. You know, it was basically two men having a conversation on the phone, and he was coming off a really hard relapse. And he was hurting, and we were going into the big book, and we're walking through some stuff, and finally said, he goes, we should really start a big book meeting. I'm like, yeah, you should, right? and he's not the first newcomer to have a lot of enthusiasm, let's just say, in early recovery, and most of the time it pitters out, but me as a sponsor, I'm there to match those efforts. And I got a hold of my sponsor in Texas, and we got some information. And he went for it. He got going, right? And it's really cool to see the big book making a comeback in this city. Because this is the only big book meeting in our city. And I do believe that to be quite important. I'm just going to share a couple of cool little notes that I wrote in regards to the big book. There's been 50 million copies of this sold, which I think is a really cool stat. Mm-hmm. 227 anonymous fellowships have picked up the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Right? So this has been the driver of so many other fellowships. Named by Time Magazine as one of the most influential books written in English. Library of Congress named it as one of the books that helped shape America. Arguably the most important thing to happen in the 20th century. Millions of lives have been saved by the message that's in this book. So that's a pretty cool deal. So the topic of unity, I want to talk about what brings us together, like we've just read in the page 17. We have one common problem. What's our common? We come from all walks of life here, right? We're normally people that wouldn't mix. We all have something called alcoholism, and we all have something called a common solution, as described from the big book. But what I want to talk about today is, I didn't want to get into my war stories at all, and I'm going to say a few things tonight that I would never say in a meeting. You're going to hear me talk about drugs, and you're going to hear me talk about a few things that don't belong in the meetings, frankly, because they just don't belong there. But I was told they do belong from a podium or on a 12-step call, so I will say some stuff tonight I wouldn't normally say. Where do I want to go with this? What does it mean to be an alcoholic? So, again, as I talked about before, I was never really sure what it meant to be an alcoholic, right? I always thought it had to do with the war story. And what I learned, as per the big book, is, and I'll share my experiences with each of these, is I have a three-part problem. The first part of my problem is a physical allergy to alcohol. And it's something that doesn't get discussed that much in our rooms, right? What that basically means is, when you take alcohol, ethyl alcohol, and you put it in my system reacts differently than the average person. This only applies to about 10% of the population. 90% of the people can safely drink, right? What that looks like for me is I plan on having one or two drinks, and I have significantly more, right? I can look back at my drinking experience over the years is, you know, I planned on having one or two, but I get thirsty after the first drink, not before, right? I want more. Does anyone here have a food allergy? What happens when you, what's your food allergy?
Gluten.
Gluten. What happens when you have it?
I throw up.
You throw up. So let me ask you this. Do you think childhood trauma caused your food allergy? Probably not, right?
I could make that argument.
Okay, well. let's use a different analogy. Let's use the analogy of strawberries, being allergic to strawberries, right? The high likelihood that my allergy to strawberries wasn't caused by childhood trauma. You know, I know that a lot of people have suffered childhood trauma in recovery, and I think it's important that you visit that, and I think it's important you get outside help with that. But not everybody. I don't believe that to be the cause. I believe this to be genetic in nature. I believe this to be handed down through generations. For me, if I look at my family tree and give it a good shake, there's alcoholics littered absolutely everywhere, right? I actually had a good upbringing, you know? Here's the funny thing is, I went to a treatment center years ago and spent a lot of money to be there, but they came from the idea that all addiction is a result of childhood trauma. And they weren't gonna let me leave until I came up with something. And I did. By the time I left, I blamed my parents for it, right? And again, I don't want to dismiss anyone that has had childhood trauma. I think it's something that's really important to deal with, right? I'm a big believer in outside help. But for myself, I didn't come from that. You know, I had a good family. I had a good upbringing. I had good parents. You know, they're alcoholic. Or my dad was an alcoholic, but he was a good man, right? My life wasn't perfect, but it was good. The allergy I believe to be is genetic in nature. And what happens with me and the allergy is it leads me into different things. In my early drinking, the allergy would, sometimes I'd plan on having one or two drinks and I'd have one or two drinks, you know. But my drinking career progressed, pretty much every single time when I planned on having one or two, I would have significantly more. Right? And then that led me into a world of drugs as well. I did a lot of cocaine and I did a lot of other stuff. I slept around a lot. There was a lot of gambling. There was a lot of things, but everything always started with the first drink. Right? And I would never really know what was going to happen. It's funny because there were so many people that would say to me, it's like, Mark, we didn't even realize you were that bad. You know, we didn't realize that you're that bad. They would see me at 9, 10 o'clock, you know, or earlier. You know, but what would happen to me is I'd disappear and I'd take off alone. And I'd go buy a 40 of whiskey, an 8-ball of cocaine, go home, Percocet, sleeping pills. I spice the night up with a Viagra, right? So... And I'd wander around with a baseball bat, alone, staring out my window, looking for cops in my trees. You know, that's what I would do. That's where the allergy took me. That was no longer fun. You know, so the physical allergy to me was. I like analogies, and I like the analogy is the allergy can be looked at like sex, like having sex with a gorilla. Once it starts, it ain't over till the gorilla says it's over. But it's a three-part problem. That's only one part of the problem. The next part of the problem, because here's the deal. If I got an allergy to strawberries, pretty simple solution. Just quit eating strawberries, right? But the second part of my problem, or in any other alcoholic problem, as per the big book, is I have a mental obsession of the mind. And that's where my alcoholism lives. I have a mind that always wants to take me back to the first drink. Basically a sober blackout. I can't remember all the bad stuff that I've done. Right? What goes through my head is somehow, someday, this time it's going to be different. Some examples. I'm actually just going to read something from the big book here. And bear with me. Which I think truly helps explain the mental obsession. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. That's what makes me an alcoholic. Anyone that tells me in the past that they chose not to drink today, there's a pretty good chance they're not an alcoholic, right? What the big book's telling me is that I've lost the ability to choose. I'm drinking against my will. I was drinking against my will. Some examples of that would be my first DUI. And I remember making a deal with God. It's like, oh, God, please just get me through this. And I promise I'll never drink again. Right? And I was drinking again shortly after. I got a second DUI. It's like, please, God, just help let me get through this one. And I promise I won't drink again. And I was drinking again. And then there was another time I'm wired up to a polygraph test to see if I'm going to be spending 7 years in prison. Not a fun experience. And RCMP officer, about 6'4", he's there to break me, and I'm just praying, right? It's like, God, please just get me through this. And I promise I will never drink again. And I got through it, and someone else went to prison as a result, and I was drinking again. You know? There was a time in Mexico. I got, I can't believe I'm saying this on mic. In Mexico, I got busted by the Mexican feds with a whole bunch of cocaine. And that doesn't go over very well down there. And I'm making a deal with God again. It's like, God, please, just get me through this one. And I promise, that's the most scared I've ever been in my life, right? I promise I won't do this again. And I meant it. Each and every one of those times, I would have passed a polygraph test. That's how much I meant it. You know, and I quit for my kid before, I quit for a woman before, I quit for a job before. Every time I meant it so much that I would have passed a polygraph test. Now, thank God the Mexican feds are crooked and I was able to buy them off. And, but again, within 24 hours, I'm back at it, right? I've lost the ability to choose whether I drink or not. A good analogy for the mental obsession would be this. Like a dog returning to its vomit, you know? It's like, the dog knows it's a bad idea. It's like, if you were to say to him, like, if he could talk, he's like, yep, this is a really bad idea, but here I go. And I'm not sure why, right? I'm really not even sure. I don't even know why I'm doing this, but I'm going to do it, you know? And that's the crazy part of this illness. I got a physical allergy. I got a mental obsession. And at the root of it all, and it's a part that we don't talk about that much, is the spiritual malady. I have a malady of the spirit, and this is how I feel in a sober state. I started drinking at the age of 12, and I think I needed one at the age of 6. That's about how far back I can remember where I didn't feel okay inside. I felt separate from other people. I felt alone. Even in a room full of people, I would feel alone. I was absolutely full of fear, right? Alcohol took all that away. My relationship with alcohol was absolutely wonderful and amazing. And it worked for me for a really long time. The big book clarifies this with three terms. Restless, irritable, and discontent. This is how I feel in a sober state, right? That's actually what drove me into alcohol. It further clarifies it with some stuff. It's called the bedevilment sense on page 52, and I'll just read them here. It asks me, were you having trouble in personal relationships? Were you having trouble controlling your emotional nature? Were you prey to misery and depression? Were you having trouble making a living? Did you have a feeling of uselessness? Were you full of fear? Were you unhappy? Were you having trouble being of real help to other people? Right? That explains me without alcohol. When I quit drinking, that's when my problems start. So alcohol worked for me for a really long time. We had a love affair. I liked myself better when I was drinking. And from ages about 12 to about 25, it worked like a charm. You know, it worked great. I was better with booze. And then it quit working. Something happened along the way, it actually quits working. And that's where my troubles really began. For I think that's the thing that people that aren't alcoholic will never really understand about us. It's like, why can't you just stop? It's like, if you knew how I felt inside when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't ask me that question. You know, it's the only thing that ever took away the pain. So for me, just quit drinking is like a form of torture. And that's, for me, it's, I mean, I would try to hang on for dear life in this program or even just in sobriety, right? And I never could for very long. You know, for me, sobriety was a form of torture. I needed a replacement. I needed the 12 steps and I needed God. Right? For me, just going to a whole pile of meetings didn't treat it. I always had the idea that outside stuff would treat my spiritual malady. And I chased money, I chased women, I chased power. My really good example of this is, and I think as alcoholics, we're really mislabeled sometimes. We're driven. The alcoholics I know are absolutely driven people. We are got all sorts of willpower in every other part of our life. Right? And a good example of this for me was I got involved with a group out in Victoria, BC, Bear Mountain Condo Project. And I wasn't even a real estate agent. But I got involved in this project and I was able to, through this obsessive crazy mind of mine, I was able to sell 44 condos in a really short period of time from my basement in Alberta. Right? And that was as much as their entire staff combined on site. So the ownership group was a group of NHL players. And they had me come out there in honor of what I was doing. And these guys are household names. Two of them are in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Big deals, right? And they have this dinner in my honor. And I'm thinking, I have arrived. You know, this is it. This is my moment. And I'm sitting there with dinner with these guys, and it's about six or eight NHL players, and like I said, a couple of them are Hall of Famers. And I'm sober. And I'm crawling out of my skin. I feel absolutely worthless. I feel like I shouldn't be there. I don't feel like I deserve to be there. And the only thing I'm looking at is, where's the wine? Right? That's all I'm staring at. They're talking to me, and I'm just like, oh, coming out of my skin. Right? The spiritual malady. Coming out of my skin in a sober state. Pour myself a glass of wine, guzzle it. They're looking at me, right? Like, are you okay? And about halfway down in my second glass of wine, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can breathe. I can talk, right? And then I became the man that they'd known. Before, I was just that scared, frightened 12-year-old child sitting there with a bunch of men thinking that I'm something that I'm not. You know, the spiritual malady. So I believe that's what we all have in common, three-part problem. I don't believe that our war stories bring us together. I believe that they push us apart. What else do we have in common? What we have in common, I believe, is a three-part solution. A three-part problem, a three-part solution. One is recovery, which is the meetings and the 12 steps. Two is unity, which is meetings and fellowship, service, which is sponsoring other alcoholics, helping, this kind of stuff, chairing meetings, sharing hope, right? I was in and out of meetings for 7 years trying to get sober. And I wasn't getting it, you know, and I'd go to meetings. I remember getting drunk right after a meeting. I was in a church basement and I'm new. And I'm hearing one person after another, after another, after another. One guy's complaining about traffic. The next guy's complaining about his wife. The next guy's complaining about his job. And everyone's just complaining and complaining and complaining. Right? I'm like, if this is recovery, I'm taking my chances out there. You know? And the thing is, I kept coming in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. And the only thing that I was being told was go to more meetings. Go to more meetings, more meetings, 90 and 90. And I remember doing about 100 meetings in 90 days and wanting to put a bullet in my head. Meetings was not treating my spiritual malady. I needed to do the full program. And that's the promise that was made to me by my sponsor real early. Promise that I make to anyone that I work with is I draw the circle and the triangle, recovery, unity, and service. And my promise to anyone that I work with is if you live in the center of the circle and the triangle, you will not drink again. Whenever I call my sponsor out in Texas, and usually to whine about relationship issues, he always asks me, before he gets into anything, it's like, where are you? Plot yourself. Where are you in the circle and the triangle? Are you getting to meetings? When's the last time you took a newcomer through the steps? Are you starting your day with prayer and meditation? Are you doing inventory step 10 and 11 at night? Right? Are you doing the deal? You know, what I find that is when I'm living in the middle of the circle and the triangle, all the assholes seem to just leave town. You know, this is a disease of perception. It really it is. You know, my perception changes completely when I'm doing this whole deal, when I'm doing this whole program. And why do I do it? I do it for the same reason why I drank and drugged. I like the effect it produces. In the doctor's opinion, it tells us we drink and drug for the effect. It makes us feel better until it quits working. And I needed a substitute for that. So that's why I work this program like the desperation of a drowning man. You know, I do the whole deal because I like the effect it produces. I like to feel okay in my skin. I don't want to go around this world in a sober state. I want to be excited about recovery. I want to go live a really cool life. I think that's what God meant for us to do. Right? And that's what I do is I try to live in the center of this. I certainly do not do this perfectly by any means. But I have a program that can get me back on track. I welcome the suffering now. This program is easy when life is good. You know? But the suffering, it always drives me deeper back into it. I knew I was coming up here a long time ago. And, you know, last week I went and did another step 5 with my sponsor because I'm trying to clear the channel. I'm trying to clear the channel. I was a little twisted up, right? You know, I'm doing the deal. I spent a lot of time in prayer and meditation the last couple of days, you know, because I like the effect it produces. I needed a substitute. I'm going to talk about hitting bottom and some of the important players in my life. I hit my bottom when I had everything. And it didn't make sense to a lot of people. I hit a external bottom in my early 30s. I was broke. I had a business that was on the verge of bankruptcy. I was living in a friend's basement on a blow-up bed. And life was not good. That to me was my external bottom. Right? But I had it in my mind that I had a case of the onlys. If I could only just get the girl. If I could only just get the job. If I could only just get the house. If I could only just get a nice vehicle. Right? And through my 30s and maybe a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work, I got everything I thought I wanted. And I remember being in Maui, looking in the mirror and staring at myself. I'm like, shit, it's still there. You know? It's still there. I had everything. I had absolutely everything. I was there with a beautiful woman. I had money. I had everything. I think bottom can come on a park bench or on Park Avenue. You know, you see millionaires blowing their brains out all the time. The external stuff does not solve my spiritual malady. I went about a 30-day stretch. I was completely spiritually sick, and I had no idea what was going on. I'd been in and out of the doctors for a long time, and I was labeled as PTSD, manic, bipolar, depressed, right? All these different things. And I was given all these different meds for all of it along the way. And at the end of the day, I got to find out I'm just a garden variety alcoholic, right? You know, I haven't done anything for a long time. But there was a period of time, that 30 days, and the bottom hit in Maui, and I went for about 30 days, and it was really hard to explain, but I thought I was going to die every minute of every day for about 30 days. And my eyes were all swelling, and there was a lot of fear. I remember going to the doctor, and I'm like, there's something wrong. I'm dying. I was actually writing my obituary, right? And I remember getting these blood tests done. I'm fully expecting them to be fatal, right? And the doctor's going, you're okay. Like, I'm not okay. Clearly, I'm not okay. But it's funny that, and I was a self-proclaimed atheist and a self-proclaimed agnostic, but I really wasn't. I would pray if I had too much drugs and I felt like I was going to OD. I'd pray when I was in the courtroom. I'd pray for a girl to come into my life. I'd pray for a girl to leave my life. So I don't know if I was really agnostic or atheist after all. But the funny thing was, is I knew exactly where to go and what to do during that period of time in Maui. I started doing the Lord's Prayer at night because I didn't think I'd make it through the night. You know, I thought I was going to die. And a few things happened shortly after that. I think with all of us, there's a defining moment, whether it's a conversation, a phone call, wandering into a meeting, a chance conversation, a Facebook post, whatever it may be. There's a defining moment which changes your entire life. For me, it was a click of a mouse. I was dying in the rooms of AA. 7 years in and out, in and out, in and out. And I clicked on to an online meeting. And it was not like a meeting I had ever been exposed to before. Everyone was very friendly to me at first. And but they were a group that they really didn't care about how I felt. They really didn't care about what I thought. The only thing that they cared about was me taking some actions. And the deal was with this group is that you were going to be assigned a sponsor that day or leave. Right? And I was pissed off because didn't they know about my feelings and how important I was? But I was intrigued. It was the first group that that would rather step on my toes and stand on my grave. And I got my first sponsor there. And it was a female out of New York. And she took me through this work and she was saying some stuff that I'd never heard before. And she took me through this work at a really rapid pace. And I got well quick. Something happened. It was almost abnormally simple. Didn't make sense to my intellectual mind. And it went really good. And I remember they really pushed us into getting working with other people really quickly, right? And I remember calling this lady after the fact. Again, wanting to discuss relationship issues. And this lady was very blunt with me. And the question that she would always ask whenever I'd call is, did you help another alcoholic today? And if the answer was no, click. Conversation was over. Now, I personally don't do that. I'm harsh, but not that harsh. But what it did is it taught me my ultimate pathway out of this. Right? If selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, then getting out of self is my answer to this. And I was a skilled manipulator and I was a skilled liar. And it was the first person that told me the truth. And it launched me into sponsorship is what it did. You know, and I was absolutely frightened. I was frightened to sponsor people and I was scared. You know. But I brought these ideas back to Medicine Hat about doing the work quickly, announcing yourself as a recovered alcoholic, following the instructions of the big book as per described, and I was welcomed with open arms, and that's the rest of the story. So, no, that's not what happened. I got a lot of pushback. And I ended up going back out one more time. And then I came back in again. And I launched into this program, right? I started sponsoring in 2 months and I have not looked back. I've taken, God, somewhere between 50 and 60 people through this work, either in a sponsorship or a co-sponsorship position, you know, because I like the effect it produces. And unbeknownst to me is a lot of these people are staying sober. A lot of you are here today, you know, and thank you. You're the ones that are keeping me sober. There's been many times I've thought about leaving this fellowship. You know, There's been some old timers that have made things fairly difficult, and there's been a lot of gossip, and there's been a lot of slander. But when you start seeing people get well quickly, you know, man, there's not a drink or drug like that. There's absolutely no drink or drug like that out there. So thank you for all of you that have stayed. There's three people I want to draw attention to that have been influencers in my recovery since my original sponsor, who I've moved away from. Around 4 months sober, I started listening to the audios of a man, Chris Raymer. And he was talking in a fashion I've never heard before. He was very blunt. He was critical. He told the truth. And I listened to him. Tape after tape after tape after tape. I kept listening to him. He worked at a treatment center in Texas. And I became a sobriety stalker. I listened to one of his tapes quite clearly, and I listened to where he worked at, and I found out the treatment center he worked at. So I went online, and I found his email address. And I emailed him, and he answered. And I emailed him again, and he answered. And we started talking on the phone. And then about 1 year sober, I asked the big question, like, will you sponsor me? And he didn't say yes right away. He says, let's talk about what that's going to look like. You know, the last thing he needed, he speaks all over the world from the podium. And the last thing he needed was a high maintenance sponsee. And I've been with him for 5 years now. And he's been a huge influencer in my life. You know, he's a cool guy. A lot of you I know have listened to him. Dale. Dale's been a big influencer as well. I remember when I came back to the meetings here and I was sharing the message out of the big book and that you could get well in this program quickly. I'm like, oh, Dale's going to be pissed, right? Because he intimidated me because he knew what he was talking about. And I was already taking a lot of heat. And I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to say what I'm up to. And I remember him saying very specifically to me, he goes, that's all a product of good sponsorship. That's all directly what's in our literature. You're doing things right. I'm like, oh, thank God. I got an ally finally, you know. And Dale's been a big influencer. And, you know, I don't talk to Chris that much. I talk to Dale quite often. You know, and the word sponsor is actually nowhere in our big book. It's not in there. You know, I have different mentors. I have a variety of mentors that I go to. And a third guy is here right now, Greg. Pastor Greg. I met Greg when I think I was about 8 months sober. And one of my friend's kids had just died due to an overdose. And he spoke at the funeral. And he spoke really well. And I listened to him and I heard him. And the next day, I'm driving. I'm still in the oil patch at the time. And I'm driving home. I'm driving to Brooks. I pull over to the side of the road and I call the Dream Center. I'm like, not even sure exactly why I'm calling you. But I heard you speak yesterday and I'm involved in AA. And what I'm finding is I'm working with a lot of people and I'm finding a lot of them have a difficulty being fully honest with me on their step five. Would you be willing to get involved? And he's like, absolutely. And he made some calls to some other priests and some other pastors and Greg's gone on to do 50, 60 step fives. Yeah. So he's been a huge, huge influencer in recovery in Medicine Hat here. I know some of you have done your step fives with him. I know I have too. I remember going to see him with my step five because I didn't feel comfortable. There's a couple things I held back on, right? And I remember going to see him to do my step five, nervous as I was tonight, maybe more. And I'm holding this document like the secret CIA document. Right? And I let it all go that day, you know? And he's like, if there's a name for it, someone else has already done it. And it was good. But I remember a conversation that I had with him. I showed up with a big book and I gave it to him and he's like, can I be honest with you? I'm like, absolutely. He goes, I got a bit of a beef with your program. I'm like, oh, what is that? He's like, you got to tell everyone you're sick for the rest of your life. I'm like, that's not true. And I opened up the big book and I showed him the very first promise on the big book, which is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And then I showed him why the book was written. So this is precisely to show other alcoholics how we have recovered. And then I showed him on page 90 of the book. It's like, we are to draw attention to ourselves as people who have recovered. He's like, you know what? He goes, I didn't know any of that. He goes, I was under the impression that you had to tell everyone you were sick for the rest of your life. I'm like, that's not a message of hope, right? I'm well today. You know, my life is good. And I think that that's a message I want to give to the newcomer, is you can get well, and you can get well quickly. The obsession can be removed, right? I have a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition. I can never safely put alcohol in my body. Abstinence is my only answer. That is not what recovered means. Does not mean cured. I can, doesn't matter how much spiritual work I do, doesn't matter how much time I have in, doesn't matter how many people that I sponsor, I can never safely put alcohol in my body due to the physical allergy. We talked about that. That physical allergy never goes away. Recovered has to do with the mental obsession. I do not obsess about alcohol. I've went through some really hard times in sobriety. I know some people, their life has become absolutely on fire in sobriety, and I welcome that, because it's absolutely, I love hearing those stories. I've been challenged a lot in sobriety. My mom has died, my dad has died, my uncle I was close to, my aunt I was close to, my family's been torn apart. I had a long distance relationship, long term, basically get shredded, you know. But my story from the podium is, during all those times of hardship, not once did I obsess about drinking. And I think that's the message of hope that the newcomer needs to hear, is that we have a solution during the bad times, right? Not just the good times. Recovery is easy when things are good. You know? But what are you going to do when the tide turns? Right? What are you going to do when she leaves or he leaves, or when you lose a job or a family member dies? Right? This program, this book gives me a solution for that. Oh, what's my life like now? I can walk this earth a free man. You know, I couldn't do anything before. I was so riddled in fear. I went to Las Vegas 6 times in the last 12 months. Now, that would make an addiction counselor's mind explode, right? My sponsor tells me that trigger is the name of a horse and it's dead. You know, if you work a good, strong program, you can do stuff. You know, I'm not reckless. All my trips are based in recovery. I've got tons of friends in Las Vegas in recovery now. I think that's what we're meant to do, is go live a really cool and exciting life in recovery. Right? I don't think it's supposed to be dumb, dull and boring. You know? And what I find is the more people I work with, lack of power is my dilemma. The more people that I work with, the more people that I try and help, I'm given power. Right? I don't even know how this thing works. It's just bizarre sometimes to me. But before I go on a trip, I'll make sure I do some work with somebody, right? And I'm lifted up. My spirits are lifted. And I can go do that work. And I can go travel. And I can go do some really cool things. My life has purpose. Before, my purpose was making money, chasing women, power, right? All external stuff. There was a group that I created a few years ago called Solution to Recovery. And basically what it was is we're having such a difficult time sharing the message. And it was originally me and Ryan H. that just started sharing a few audios. And a few more people, and there was a few more people, and a few more people, and then I created I didn't want me to be known as the trusted authority, and the middle of the night this name just came to me, Solution to Recovery, and I went and registered the domain, and started sending some audios and stuff from there, and this thing just, something really crazy started to happen, and my sponsor sponsors 35 men from all over the world, and he had these 35 men added to it, and what ended up happening is these articles I was sending out, Google started to block me because it got too big. They thought I was spam. You know, this thing just kept on growing. There was a real need, a real want for a solution, right? So this girl out of Calgary gave me a hand, and we got this thing up and going and moved it over to MailChimp. And this thing is, I've got 250 people on this list here now from all over the world, you know, and I didn't see that coming. I didn't see anything like that coming. That wasn't my plan. And it's pretty cool because with MailChimp, you send an article out and you can see where it goes, right, throughout the world. So I'm looking at this and I send an article out and some are more popular than others and you can see this world map start lighting up as these articles get forwarded and forwarded and I'm staring at my screen like a little crackhead, right, watching this thing go across the world. So, but it's cool, right? I didn't see any of this kind of stuff coming. My life has purpose. My life has meaning. I'm going to finish with an article here. I think I got time, right?
Yep.
This is someone from my sponsorship lineage that lives out in Toronto. And I condensed this article because it was fairly long, but I want to finish with this. I like the article and maybe I can mend a few fences that I might have burned down here. It's called Confessions of a Big Book Sponsor. And I condensed this. I remember asking someone in the fellowship a few years ago, "Are you working your program?" He replied, "Yes, I went to a meeting today." I responded, "No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone?" He said, "Yes, I have a sponsor." I replied, "No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with a newcomer?" He said, "I'm just a few months sober. I'm only a newcomer. This is a selfish program. I need to work on myself first." I never saw him again. Who am I? I'm a big book sponsor. I practice a 12-step program as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The original recipe for recovery is practiced by the original 100 who recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You can recognize me at 12-step meetings because I'm the one who brings my own big book. To show other alcoholics precisely how I have recovered is the main purpose of this book. I carry a common solution, a way out in which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join together as brothers and sisters in harmonious action. My deportment shouts that I am a person with a real answer. I carry no attitude of holier than thou. I do not talk down to the alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. I ask for no payment. I have no axes to grind, nor people to please. You can expect to endure no lectures from me. My only desire is to be helpful. I offer friendship and fellowship. What do I do? You will find me at 12-step meetings, armed with the facts about myself. As an ex-problem drinker, you will see me making an approach to the newcomer, looking for someone who needs and wants to hear about our common solution, someone with an honest desire to stop, someone who wants what I have and is willing to follow instructions as outlined in the big book, someone who wants to be joyous and free of active alcoholism. Working with other alcoholics. I've carried the message of the big book to many alcoholics, and rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Untreated alcoholics are unlovely people. My struggles with them are strenuous, comic, and tragic. Those who could not or would not see our way of life are often consumed by their temptations, which leads them to the gates of insanity or death. I have worked hard with many alcoholics on the idea that only an alcoholic can help another alcoholic. I have had many failures. I once asked another big book sponsor about their success rates, and she replied, "I'm 100% successful." Astounded, I asked, "How is that possible?" She replied, "I'm still sober." To me, that's one of the best-kept secrets in our fellowship today. I often hear that this is a selfish program, but whenever I put my sobriety first, I could never stay sober. As Dr. Bob once remarked, strenuous one-on-one work with another alcoholic was vital to permanent recovery. Love and tolerance of others is my code. In the 12-step rooms, I've been accused of being a step Nazi, a big book thumper, a holy roller, a zealot, a big book page pusher, and recently I was called a step tard. I've been thrown out of groups and asked not to come back. I have been asked not to bring my big book into some AA meetings. I've been physically and verbally threatened by members of the fellowship for teaching the 12-step program can be learned in a week. I have been blamed for killing people with the big book. When confronted with such animosity, my program tells me to look at my part. Have I been crusading, righteous, or critical? Have I been engaging in frothy debates or windy arguments? Have I been demonstrating an attitude of intolerance? Yes, There have been times when I have been all these things, but I claim spiritual progress, not perfection. I am no saint. I confess that I am a big book fundamentalist. I work my big book like a recipe of recovery. When I follow the 12 steps instructions as outlined in the big book, it awakens my mind and I make conscious contact with a higher power. I must remember that when I focus my mind on what is wrong with the fellowship and the meetings today, then I become more restless, irritable, and discontent. I must remember that the meetings are filled with many suffering and untreated alcoholics, many of them with long-term sobriety time. Therefore, I practice acceptance and focus on what is good about the meetings and the fellowship. I try to see how I can positively add to the meeting. My only desire is to be helpful. Sometimes I have charged the meeting makers of killing people with their don't drink and go to meetings mantra. In return, the meeting makers Make It Sect have accused me of killing people with my big book thumping attitude. What I've learned is this. It is not the meeting makers that are killing people, nor is it the big book thumpers. It's a 20 to 30 years of abusive drinking and using drugs that's killing alcoholics and addicts. I must remember that I have no monopoly on recovery, but I do know that the big book solution works. Why do I continue to work with other alcoholics? Over the years, I've witnessed a fellowship grow up around me. I've watched a spirit grow in the eyes of a suffering individual and seen them recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I've seen them make a 180-degree turn in life, only to help some other suffering alcoholic do the same. This is the experience I would not miss. I know you will not want to miss it either. Frequent contact with newcomers of the big book sponsors is the bright spot in my day. A vision for you. Thus I grow spiritually, and so can you with the big book in hand. It contains all you will need to begin working with the alcoholic who still suffers. I know what you were thinking. I'm only a newcomer myself. I do not have enough sobriety time to be useful to anyone. What could I possibly offer a newcomer? Maybe I should wait a year or two. Rubbish. By working the big book solution, you will tap into a source of a power greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what I've accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. Remember, your alliance is always upon your higher power. It will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Ask in morning meditation what you can do for the alcoholic who still suffers. The answers will come if you work your program. But if you're on shaky ground, you'd better work with another alcoholic instead. Remember, you have recovered and you've been given the power to help others. You will soon find out that when all other measures fail, work with another alcoholic will save the day. Give freely of what you have been shown and join us in the broad highway of fellowship and spirit. You will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. Trust God, clean house, and help others. That's it.